Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show.
Happy Tuesday, and welcome to the Lars Larson Show and to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 years. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails in just a moment. I want to get started with a big question that is not being asked by the mainstream media, and in fact, it affects just about everybody who lives in the region. I want to remind you, we put up a Twitter poll question as well. That one's a bit different. Should taxpayers subsidize electric cars for the poor? And if you say, well, the federal government already does that, are you ready to see your state tax dollars be used to offer up thousands of dollars so that poor people can buy electric cars that for many of them don't make any sense? Now, frankly, I think they don't make any sense for most people, no matter what your paycheck is, no matter what your income tax bracket is. But now the state of Oregon is going to throw out $5,000 so that poor people can buy electric cars. And we can talk about some of the practical problems of that. But you can find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. And if you don't like Twitter, go to my website. It's LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. I want to start with this question. I think it's a fairly simple one. Oregon, Washington, perhaps even Idaho, have created their own problems with the COVID lockdowns, with the COVID quarantine restrictions, with the vaccine mandates, and we've talked about these quite a bit. But the question I want to ask for today that I don't hear the major media asking, I don't hear TV asking it, for the most part, I don't hear radio asking it, I certainly don't hear the Daily Dead Fish Wrappers, you know, the Oregonian, the Seattle Times, the Eugene Cash Register Guard, the Tri-Cities Herald. Why aren't they asking this question? Do our leaders have the guts to admit the mistake they made and fix it before it kills more people? You know that people have already died in Seattle because of lack of quick response from emergency services like medical and police. We've already documented cases like that. But what brought this to mind today were several things. Number one, citing a rock slide and unstable slopes, the Washington State Department of Transportation said yesterday it has closed U.S. 12 White Pass overnight because of the risk. They also say Stevens Pass is still partly buried, leaving Snoqualmie Pass as the only route across the Cascade still open. But drivers on that route ran into problems with a lot of travel lanes hidden under the snow. The area also does not have any place for trucks and cars to put on tire chains. And you say, well, that's Lars, that's a transportation problem. That's not a COVID problem. Yes, it is. Because over the last several months, with the assistance of people like the Cascade Policy Institute and the Washington Policy Center and people like Maria Frost, we've documented that the state of Washington decided to get rid of a whole bunch of WashDOT workers, including, most significantly, men and women who drive the snow plows. And at the time, Maria Frost was predicting we're going to have big problems with the passes. And sure enough, we do. It's a pass problem. It's a snow problem. But it's also a COVID problem, because we pointed out the great irony that WashDOT had decided they would not employ anybody who had not taken the jab. So you get rid of all those drivers, you can't replace them, and you just tell citizens, by the way, cargo and you will not be moving over that pass, which is leaving empty store shelves in parts of Washington state. It's leaving people stuck or stranded or with extraordinarily long times to get from point A to point B. That is a COVID problem. Does the state have the guts to say we were wrong to insist on the jab? And I've pointed out to you that some other states have addressed this in their hospitals, saying we better hire back those unvaccinated doctors, nurses, and other staff members. Second example, COVID-19 causes a bus driver shortage problem that leaves Vancouver schools to implement rotating remote learning. Why? They can't get enough people to drive the buses. And why? Again, because of quarantines, because of jab requirements, and all the rest. And then you've got the Oregon rationing plan, as detailed by our friends at the Taxpayers Association of Oregon. Oregon health officials have just released their crisis care protocol, which spells out how hospitals should ration health care to decide who lives and who dies in the expectation of a looming Omicron surge. Well, let me poke a couple of holes in the Omicron surge in just a moment. Oregon's gone back-to-back, record-breaking virus days, et cetera, et cetera. I'll tell you more about those numbers in a moment. But what's happened is Oregon is rated as having the fewest hospital beds in America per capita. That's because Oregon has 15,000 healthcare workers missing from the field. And of course, it's hard to hire people. Oregon has among the strictest rules during the pandemic. Oregon is among six states with the strictest and least flexible vaccine mandates for healthcare workers, and that has created a healthcare shortage, with an awful lot of healthcare workers being laid off. So when they tell you we're short and it's because we're overwhelmed by Omicron, no, you're short because you got rid of the people who do the job, you knuckleheads. It's time to reverse that policy. Extended non-emergency delays. By not hiring new workers early and often, Oregon delays non-emergency care appointments and services, and that backlog just builds. And then they've wasted existing COVID funds. Politicians want to spend billions on self-serving or popular projects instead of the practical. Hire some more healthcare workers. And we're in a labor shortage. Forecasted healthcare rationing, politicians refusing to spend the money. Oregon has $1.4 billion in unspent emergency COVID funds. And what does the governor do? Governor Kate Brown, in this case, says, I'll send the National Guard down so we can have lieutenants and sergeants pushing brooms and emptying trash cans. Let me give you a taste of where I think some of the answer is suggested. And it comes from a doctor. This doctor is at the University of California, San Francisco Hospital System, which is in the same boat as Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Dr. Jean Ann Noble, who's an associate professor of medicine at UCSF. And she says, look, the real COVID crisis, this is a quote from her, that our hospitals are facing is a severe staffing shortage that is compromising the quality of care. And she says, quote, as currently reported, COVID hospitalization rates greatly exaggerate the COVID burden. Incidental positives account for the large majority of hospitalized cases. What does she mean by incidental positives? An incidental positive would be you're going in to have some other medical procedure done that has nothing to do whatsoever with COVID or Omicron or vaccines or jabs or anything else. And they say, by the way, we test all of our patients. So they test you. And you have an asymptomatic case of COVID or Omicron. And they say, okay, we're going to count you as an Omicron case. What? You're going to count that? This doctor in a responsible position at that hospital system. And by the way, the hospital systems of the Northwest have consistently turned us down. When we call them and say, will you come on and explain what's going on? They consistently refuse. And I think I know the reason why. They have, as the doctor said, greatly exaggerated the burden of COVID. Why? Because they deliberately fired a bunch of people. And if you find out, if citizens find out that the hospitals are in the lurch, because they fired a bunch of their people, then they need to have an excuse. And they can point to those numbers and say, there's our excuse. We'll blame it on COVID like everybody else is doing. In any case, welcome to Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network, 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. In a moment, I'll tell you why we've come to the strangest day. I actually agree with U.S. Senator Jeff Berkley. We'll talk about that next on the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish wrapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
2022 gets off to a truly strange start with Oregon Democrat U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley saying something that I actually agree with. Merkley slammed House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for defending the kind of insider stock trading done by Congress critters on Capitol Hill. Pelosi has a net worth north of $100 million. Her husband's even richer. Both of them make a lot of money on stocks. So when reporters asked about members of Congress trading on their inside information about the direction of government policies, Pelosi backed it up. Merkley's response, when members hold individual stocks, it can't help but influence their thinking on policies and tax laws that affect their value. Wow, I agree with Merkley for a change. About Pelosi, Merkley says, on this issue, I disagree with her completely. Last year, the Breitbart News organization reported on Pelosi and her husband, Paul, making a cool $5 million trading just on technology stock options. Pelosi claims she doesn't own any of the stocks that her husband trades, but after all, she lives in California. That is a community property state, which means everything he owns, she owns as well. No wonder that public polling shows 3 out of 4 Americans believe that members of Congress and their spouses enjoy an unfair advantage when they're trading stocks. Maybe it's time for Nancy to do a little press conference, a video from her kitchen, sitting in front of that $24,000 ice cream freezer that she has. On Gitter, I got this question from Dan Solomon. He said, Lars, is Nick Kristof, the candidate case, a test case? Now, he may make a good point. You may know that the Secretary of State has decided that Nicholas Kristof, who spent the last 40 years living away from the Pacific Northwest and away from his home state of Oregon, other than what he claims are annual trips back, I would imagine he probably came home at the holidays. But Dan writes in, Lars, now they want the top court, the Supreme Court in Oregon, to declare Nicholas Kristof is an Oregonian. Next, they can now get anybody they want to run in any district. Also, this opens the door for those who believe in open boards. And this allows the courts to declare illegals as Oregonians. Signed, Dan. Dan, you could be absolutely right about that. This one, I left the name off at the request of the sender. Lars, my daughter, it's a young lady. My daughter just was sent home from school, symptom-free, from an Evergreen School District elementary school for being in close contact with somebody who has COVID. I immediately went in and asked questions like, if she's being sent home symptom-free, then what's the point of the mask? She sits here all day long in a mask and yet gets no benefit to stay in school. They also informed me that if she was vaccinated, she would be able to stay but not have to quarantine. Now, they then asked, so you're telling me that if they're vaccinated, they can't get COVID and spread it? We all know that isn't true. I have no problems following rules, but none of this makes sense. They're allowing kids to stay in school that is just as likely to be infected and spread the virus, yet my symptom-free daughter is now on remote learning again. And on top of all that, she's going to have to test negative in order to get back into school after her quarantine. Does any of this make common sense? She writes. I'm willing to give this information over the phone if you prefer, but I really hope you can shed some light on this. It just shows that they're coming after our kids and discriminating against the unvaccinated when there is still no mandate for this age group in schools. And that mom is absolutely right about it. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, I'm going to give the grill to the folks who pushed ballot measure 110. If you don't remember this, this was an Oregon ballot measure, and voters voted for it overwhelmingly. They said, let's do a drug decriminalization experiment. They have effectively legalized the possession and the consumption of the hardest drugs available in America. That includes fentanyl, it includes heroin, it includes cocaine, it includes methamphetamine. And if you say, Lars, have they legalized it? Technically, they have not legalized it. If you get caught with any of the drugs that I just mentioned, they will write you a ticket. The ticket costs $100, but all you have to do to avoid the ticket is tell them that you will talk to somebody on the phone about the possibility of you going into drug treatment. Once you've had that conversation, the $100 is waived. So you end up with nothing. No criminal conviction, no fine that you've paid, no cost to you at all except talking to somebody on the phone. Well, as Oregon Catalyst points out, in 2020, Oregon voters approved Measure 110 that decriminalizes meth and heroin and funds drug addiction and treatment and recovery services. It came into effect February 1 of last year. As predicted, fewer drug arrests were made in 2021. Instead of earning jail time, those found in possession of the drugs are charged with a violation. They pay a $100 fine, or they can avoid the fine altogether by taking part in what's called a health assessment on the phone. As of November, out of 1,500 of these tickets written, 68 people did the total health assessment screening. 49 of the callers were not interested in the resources and just said no, and they merely underwent the assessment to escape the fine. 11 people were put in touch with some kind of addiction or recovery service. And apparently, the numbers they have available, none of them actually went into drug treatment. So you have an experiment saying if we just offer people treatment instead of arresting them, instead of charging them with a crime, instead of having them in front of a judge, which often led to people going into treatment, they simply let you go. So we have effective legalization, the promise of treatment, and almost nobody has decided to sign up for it. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. The Radio Northwest Network supplies honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest. And naysayers, go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, our best email of the day so far, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest, now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and even a signing bonus. Online, you'll find them at rivercityusa.com/careers. Again, I've had to hold the name back. This is a father who wrote in and said, Lars, my daughter goes to Linfield College and has three choices at this point. She has to make one of them by 5 o'clock tonight. Get vaccinated with something that won't prevent her from getting the virus anyway and possibly suffer one of the side effects, rare side effects. Number two, remain unvaccinated and not be able to attend athletic practice at Linfield. Number three, get tested at the school and either test negative and gets to practice or test positive, even though she has no symptoms, fever, loss of smell or taste or anything else. And she not only doesn't get to practice, but she also doesn't get to attend the swim meet on Thursday and stays home for 10 days and misses in-class instruction. As of right now, she doesn't want to get tested and run the risk of testing positive. Again, she's not symptomatic. She doesn't want to get the jab if it's not going to keep her from getting the virus. So what's the point if she's young, healthy, not obese, and has no underlying conditions? So she just may be going to the meet on Thursday. Practice is at 5 o'clock today. She has till then to decide. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, a powerful network of 23 radio stations around the Pacific Northwest that bring you honestly provocative talk. Now, we've talked a lot about the crime problems of the major, mostly of the major cities here in the Pacific Northwest, and we've talked about the fact that many of those cities got rid of some of their best cops. And I wanted to talk to one of them who's willing to come on, and that is Aaron Smith, who joins me now. Officer, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Lars. Good to be with you.
How long have you been a cop?
Well, I served with Portland Police for 26 years, and I've been retired since August of 2020 when all the riots and everything was going on.
Why'd you leave?
Well, it just became a very toxic situation that was really affecting both me and my family. You know, I have a wife and two kids, and they're grown. But I mean, it was at the point that I, you know, the negativity that was going on within the bureau was affecting all of us, and I just needed to go away.
Did Portland Police Bureau invite you to come back and go back to work for them?
No. Well, originally, I put in for retiree hire and was accepted into that program. And so that was kind of the plan that I was going to do, except for Assistant Chief Ryan Lee. Kind of looked at the program, said it was going to cost too much, and so they squashed it and then told all of us that, you know, that program wasn't going to exist. And I just had to look at it and go, well, you know, what am I going to do? And I just need to retire and find something else somewhere. So that's what I did.
Okay, but how long ago was that? Because now they're on a tear to try and rehire retired cops. So when did they turn you down for the or say this program is no good, we're not going to do it?
Well, it was so I put in for the program right before I retired, right, and then got the notice that the program was no longer going to exist. And then when I heard about the retire rehire starting back up again, actually sent in an email to personnel and saying, hey, I'm hoping that you guys are going to honor the, you know, the promise that you made to people that retired back in August, and I never received any email back or any word. And what I've been told is that they're just looking for officers. I was a sergeant when I retired, and I just kind of took it as, okay, they're just looking for officers, or yeah, they're just not looking for me. I don't know.
Okay, and I wondered whether that was the case, because I've seen some of the letters that have been sent to some of the officers in which they say, if you cooperated with the federal authorities during the riots in that long summer, then you're disqualified. If you've been trained in what they called unconstitutional crowd control, I'm not even sure what that means, but it sounds like they wanted a certain kind of cop, and they wanted to screen for, did you read that the same way?
Yeah, and I did. You know, I was part of the traffic division, so I was a motor cop, I was a motor sergeant, and we were involved in a lot of the protests, we were involved in a lot of the marches that went on, and I didn't know if that was going to be something that they looked negatively against. I just had no idea. I was flabbergasted at the letter that they sent out, and just didn't understand that, you know, you can look at a person who spent 26 years with the Bureau, you know, and I've got a lot of accolades, a lot of commendations. I don't like to brag about myself, but, you know, I got the Medal of Valor and other awards assigned to me, and now I'm just kind of forgotten and passed by. So
now they don't want to talk to you. Are you the thing I'm curious about, because I can't get an answer out of the Bureau, has anybody agreed who retired to go back to work?
Not that I know of. I know, you know, the retired police community is, you know, a group that talks in and amongst ourselves, and I have not talked to anybody that is willing to go back to that toxic environment that exists right now. It's just, you know, it's not something that you want to drag your family back into.
That's the, you know, see, Aaron, that's the sense I get from the outside, is that here's the Bureau. They've made it a toxic situation. They've given a lot of people the bum's rush and pushed them to get out. They've told them, we don't like you if you cooperated with the feds. We don't like you if you took a hard line when it came to the protests. And then they say, hey, by the way, would you like to come back to work for us? And they began that program, if memory serves, back in October of last year. And to this date, I don't think they've managed to get anybody back, which I think speaks volumes about the attitude of police officers, real police officers, toward going to work for Portland.
No, it does. I'm somebody that has always been into public service. You know, I went into the military at age 17. You know, I've always tried to serve my community, and it just seemed like, you know, the government that existed in Portland just didn't want to accept me or appreciate, you know, what I was trying to give back to the community. So,
and at this point, as a recent retiree, they're not even asking you to come back, which I think sounds like an ideological cleansing that the department has gone through, where they've said, we don't want real cops. We want cops who are going to go along with the program. And if people decide to riot and burn the town down and commit murders and commit assaults, we just got to let them go. And the officers who've complained about it don't tend to get invited to come back.
Right. Now, I had the hardest time sitting in buildings like Southeast Precinct and North Precinct and whatnot, and seeing what's going on outside and not getting involved. But that's what was told to us, is that you need to sit still and not do anything until, you know, we give you the order to go out and do something. And it just, it was so frustrating, because that's not why I got into police work. That's not why I got into civil service, was to sit by and watch my city that I was born and raised in burn to the ground.
What do you think is going to happen then? I mean, because they've got all these plans. They say we had a record level of homicides last year. We've got record levels of other kinds of crime, not just murders, but rapes, but assaults, robberies, drug dealing, and everything else. Drive-by shootings at random, 100 rounds here, 50 rounds in that neighborhood. What do you see coming down the road?
I don't know, Lars. Yeah, I had such high hopes for Ted Wheeler because, as a sergeant in the traffic division, I was part of the meetings that went on when we had different protests or different events coming up. And, one of the first things I saw out of him is that he came into one of our meetings and he actually apologized for the actions that he took. But, the problem is that I saw him continue to do those same actions that, he stopped apologizing for. I mean, he was at one point somebody that was willing to say that I made a mistake and that, things need to change. But that kind of went by the wayside.
That's what it sounds like. Officer Aaron Smith, who left the Portland Police Bureau. Sorry, Sergeant Aaron Smith. Sergeant Smith, thank you very much. Coming up in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. Naysayers, of course, go first. And should taxpayers be subsidizing electric cars for the poor? We'll get to all of it next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
It's
important to note that the American people are mostly fixated on inflation. There's no relief in sight.
Gas prices.
Is everything you've been paying this much for a gallon of gas? In some parts of California, they're paying $4.50 a gallon.
Multi-trillion dollar government programs.
The price tag for this bill, $1.75 trillion. And the recovery bill passed in March is close to $5 trillion.
Big Brother has taken control and wants more from you every single day. This is Government Gone Wild.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I've got to classify this as Government Gone Wild. Oregonians considering purchasing an electric vehicle are going to get a new incentive. Isn't this great? The state of Oregon has decided to hand out $5,000 to anybody who's willing to either buy or lease a new or used fully electric or hybrid vehicle. Well, the program was started in 2018, 4 years ago. The state has paid out $41 million in clean vehicle rebates. That's what they call them. So far, Kate Brown had set a goal that by 2025, 3 years from now, the state will have a quarter of a million, 250,000 registered electric vehicles. How close are they after almost 4 years? They're at 42,000. They're not even at the 20% mark, and they've only got 3 years left to close that gap. So they're going to have to sell 200,000 plus electric vehicles in the next 3 years, about 60,000 vehicles a year, which is more than are already on the roads of the entire state after 4 years with massive subsidies. So they're going to offer the rebates, and then of course you get the federal rebates as well. All of this to get poor people. They're going to put an emphasis on doing this with households that make less than the average income out there. Now, that means that they're going to be going to poor people and saying, we'd like you to buy this fairly expensive electric car, but we'll give you $5,000 if you'll do it. In other words, Kate Brown has found a program that is so ugly that you have to tie a pork chop around its neck to get the family dog to play with it. That's exactly what they're doing. In any case, I thought I'd throw it out there. We also threw it out as the Twitter poll today. The question is, should taxpayers subsidize electric cars for the poor? My answer is no. Most poor people are too sensible to buy that kind of vehicle. They know what meets their needs. They know what's most efficient. They know where they get the biggest bang for their buck, and it ain't with an electric car. To your calls now. Let's go first to Tom in Port Orchard, listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KVI. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars, question for you, and sure. This probably sounds stupid. You know, a couple of months ago, WashDOT was saying on the news, they were warning that they were going to have problems with snowplow drivers, with all of the people that they had to let go because of the vaccine mandate in Washington State.
Yep.
That was big in the news. Now, why is it you're not hearing any of that now, other than all the news is saying is, oh, there's been record snowfall at the passes. And they're not saying anything about all of the people that they let go.
Tom, the short answer, and this is what I've complained about, Whether they like it or not, a lot of my friends in the TV business and the news business, so that's print, online, TV, radio, whatever, they carry water for state bureaucracies. And I hate it when they do that, because your job as a reporter is not to be anybody's buddy or friend and say, well, I'm doing a story about my friend the governor, my friend the mayor, my friend the city commissioner. You're supposed to ask questions just as hard of your friends as you do of people you really despise, you know, because every reporter has favorites. You say, I like this person, I don't like that person, this person's kind of a jerk, that person's very nice. But you should ask the same hard questions of all of them. And you're right. I mean, we were talking about this months ago, and Maria Frost, I have to give her a lot of credit, the Washington Policy Center, she made the point. They're getting rid of all these drivers, especially those who drive the snowplows and the dump trucks and the front-end loaders and all the other equipment you need to keep the passes open, and they don't have anybody to replace them. And even the irony that I pointed out, Tom, WashDOT said, you can't drive trucks for us if you don't take the jab. And they usually did the parking lot clearance for the State Parks Department. Well, the State Parks Department said, well, gee, since we can't get that service from WashDOT anymore, we'll hire our own drivers. They hired drivers without, and they didn't care if you were vaccinated or not. And guess what? They got all the drivers they needed. So, Tom, I guess what happens is reporters and citizens need to start saying, why aren't you getting the passes cleared? Maria Frost made the point at the time that the track record of Washington State with those passes is that they usually don't get closed. Why? Because as soon as it starts to snow, they get on top of it and they stay on top of it. And they've had a 10 or 20 year history of the snow starts, they know it's coming, they get up, they plow it as it comes, and they keep the passes open. And they might close for an hour or two, but generally they get them back open very quickly. Now we've got the 90-hour closure of Snoqualmie Pass. We've got other passes that are only sort of open right now. And what you need is reporters, and I would ask this question of Jay Inslee. He won't come on the show. I would ask it of the head of the WashDOT. They won't come on the show. We ask them all the time. We should make a list every day of all the, except it'd take up the whole show to tell you all the people who refuse to answer questions like that. But I'm going to ask them rhetorically.
Right.
Why aren't you, if you realize this vaccine mandate is crippling your ability to deliver the service that taxpayers have paid for, then why don't you reverse your decision and say this was stupid? There are institutions all over this country. USPS says we can't do the jab. It'll cripple us. Airlines have said that. Hospitals have said that. It's time for Jay Inslee and Kate Brown to do the same. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I want to tell you one of the major untold stories of what's going on with COVID is that we see an awful lot of major institutions that are being crippled, not by the disease itself, not by people getting sick, but simply by the actions of government. And I thought every time I hear about one of these, I want to bring that story to you. And usually the best way to do that is to bring somebody on who's involved in it. I got an email. We're going to call him Nick for the purposes of this interview, but not his real name. But Nick wrote to me about what was going on. And I think, Nick, tell me if I'm overstating this. When it comes to alcohol and drug treatment for American veterans, if you go to, say, the Portland metro area, you include Salem, Vancouver, Southwest Washington, the one go-to for American veterans who need to get some drug or alcohol treatment is going to be the program that you work in at the Portland VA Medical Center. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and you've been there for 8 years. You work as a nurse. What's happened there just recently?
So we found out of the blue on Friday, January 7th, that they were shutting down our program. We had 20 veterans in our program, and in a matter of hours, they shipped them, all 20 of those patients, out the door. Some went to White City, some went to hotels, some were sent home, some were even put up in seedy hotels. And we were notified as staff that they were closing the RTP, that's our program, that they were closing it because of critical staff shortages at the main hospital at Portland VA, especially in the inpatient acute psych ward unit. And so the nurses were going to be dispersed throughout the hospital to help cover because of the Omicron surge. And we were told it was done for two reasons. One, for critical staffing shortages on the acute care unit, and because the RRTP was a high-risk COVID environment because of the communal living that we have. We have a separate house by itself on the Vancouver campus. And because we had 20 patients, the VA deemed it as a high-risk place, so they closed us, even though we've been open the whole time during this pandemic from the very beginning.
Now, the RRTP is the Residential Rehab Treatment Program, which is for drug and alcohol rehab of veterans specifically. Is the rest of the hospital system short of nurses and other staff because of COVID, or is it because of vaccine jab requirements, vaccination requirements on the staff?
We're not kept in the loop on any of that. The last email I got from the CEO of the hospital was that in the hospital they have two COVID positive ICU patients and four COVID positive patients on the med surge ward. That was as of the 3rd of January.
That doesn't sound like a surge to me. What was your impression?
That was the impression of all of us, is that it doesn't sound like there's none on the acute psych ward. There's no COVID positive patients. I will add, being there for 8 years, I know that critical staffing has been short on that unit for a lot of years, for more years even prior to the pandemic. And that I've talked to people that have transferred from that unit to our unit, and majority of them say because it's a toxic work environment. So they're always been short. They've always had critical needs, but they've never had to shut our program down to help theirs.
What do you think is going to happen to your former patients?
Well, we already know that five were sent down to White City, which is an RRTP program down there.
It's in Southern Oregon, about 5 hours drive away, isn't it?
Correct. And we heard that one of the patients en route already relapsed. We've heard that several of our patients that were sent to other locations they're upset with the program. They were promised that when we reopen, they could come back. Several have said, we're not coming back. And, you know, there's a high risk. I mean, in this environment, the pandemic environment, the news is clear on it that addicts and homeless, because we also have a program in that same facility for homeless vets. You always hear about how homeless vets are in the news and we got to do something about it. And they just shut down without any notice, shut down a homeless program at the VA. It's the only homeless inpatient program in this area. And they just shut it down.
Now, you managed to get through the whole pandemic up to this point. And Omicron is less problematic in some ways because it's not sending as many people to the hospital as Delta or the original COVID. And we've got antivirals to treat it. And we've got a huge percentage of the population vaxxed. I'm just curious whether or not the vaccination question caused the VA to get rid of some of its staff who are not vaxxed. Is that the case or do you know?
We don't know. We haven't any clue. One of the things that, you know, we're kind of our own separate unit, so we're not really... Even the nurses, there's a nursing division at the hospital, but we're part of the mental health division. So we're unaware of what goes on at the main part of the hospital. And we've managed to stay open for 2 years while several, I don't know the number, but several RRTPs throughout the United States were closed because of COVID. But we've been able to stay open. We've been able to treat our patients. We had two small issues where we had to reduce our patient load down to like seven because a couple of our inpatients tested positive for COVID. But once after a 2 week program where all the staff and vets were tested every 3 days, they reopened the program. So this kind of the only word we got was it was because of the expected Omicron surge is why they're making this decision, and the critical staffing shortage on the inpatient psych unit.
By the way, you're represented by a labor union, and you contacted the union. What'd they tell you?
They told us that, first, if you step back just a second, one of our nurses, when told by her supervisor that she had to go back to the inpatient unit, asked if the union was notified, and her response was, yes, the union knows about it and has approved it. When we contacted our union representative, they said they've never had a contact, they've never approved it, nobody said anything to them, and they said that it is a violation of the labor contract for the VA, but there were special considerations at the national level because of COVID, because of the pandemic, and that it could take several months before the national organization could get rectification on the issue. And we have nurses. I have three nurses that already contacted me and said that they have PRN or as needed anxiety medicines, and they're all of a sudden after 2 years they're taking them because.
Unbelievable. Nick, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming on and telling that story. We'll talk about questions about the. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I know that people still have questions about what happened on January the 6th, and I've told people my take on January 6th of last year. That is the riot that happened at the Capitol building. There were a lot of false allegations that were made about the riot being somehow incited by Donald Trump and this kind of nonsense. It is nonsense. But the more serious questions are, was this something that was actually a created event, created by the powers that be in the FBI and other parts of the government to provide an excuse for Nancy Pelosi to carry out an unconstitutional and illegal impeachment of an American president who had less than 2 weeks left in his term in office? So this is January of last year. And some of those questions are being asked right now. And one of them concerns a guy by the name of Ray Epps. And if you have never heard that name, it may be because you're consuming too much mainstream news. Ray Epps is a United States Marine veteran, and he has been associated with a number of conservative groups. But the real question, and it got asked by Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, is, and he was asking the question of the federal authorities testifying in front of the United States Congress, is Ray Epps a federal agent? Take a listen to the question and the answer, such as it is.
On the night of January 5th, 2021, Epps wandered around the crowd that had gathered, and there's video out there of him chanting, "Tomorrow, we need to get into the Capitol, into the Capitol." This was strange behavior, so strange that the crowd began chanting, "Fed, Fed, 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 Fed." Ms. Sanborn, was Ray Epps a Fed?
Sir, I cannot answer that question.
Now, they were doing the testimony of Ms. Sanborn by video, but she answered that a lot. I can't answer the question. Now, that's a real question because after the Capitol riot, 727 people were brought up on charges. Some of those have been dropped, but the vast majority are still pending. A few people have pleaded guilty to some charges that were brought against them. Now, I know you've heard January 6th of last year called an insurrection. That it was an attempt to overthrow the government of the United States, to stop the counting of votes and to change the result of an election. The only thing is, the Department of Justice, which is who the FBI works for, did not bring any charges of sedition, did not bring any charges of treason, did not bring any charges of insurrection. And what's really interesting, with more than 700 people charged, Ray Epps is not one of those people. So Ted Cruz thought he'd ask a little bit broader question of the FBI about who was there, who was working with the FBI. Listen to this.
How many FBI agents or confidential informants actively participated in the events of January 6th?
Sir, I'm sure you can appreciate that I can't go into the specifics of sources and methods.
Did any FBI agents or confidential informants actively participate in the events of January 6th? Yes or no?
Sir, I can't answer that.
Did any FBI agents or confidential informants commit crimes of violence on January 6th?
I can't answer that, sir.
Did any FBI agents or FBI informants actively encourage and incite crimes of violence on January 6th?
Sir, I can't answer that.
Now, that's a problem. When you ask the FBI, if you've got people out there committing crimes, we understand why you would bring an action against them, have the Department of Justice bring charges against them. But if some of your agents working for the FBI, now you might wonder, Ray Epps, if you don't know the background on him, is the former president of the largest chapter of a group called the Oath Keepers. And you might wonder, well, how in the world would a guy like that in a position like that, since the Oath Keepers is a generally anti-government organization, why would he go to work for the FBI? Well, the standard way that you get somebody to go to work as an agent, not as a special agent, you know, where you're formally working for the FBI, but to go out and do the bidding of the FBI, is the FBI generally goes to somebody and says, look, we could end up charging you with crimes. We could put you away for a good long time, or you could agree to do a few things for us, which might explain why Ray Epps, former head of the Oath Keepers, who participated on January 5th and January 6th of last year, and was right there. The fact is that he might have been encouraged by the FBI to work for them under the threat of prosecution, except we don't know. We don't know if he was working for the FBI. The FBI refuses to say so. But we do know, and this goes to Ted Cruz's next question, that Ray Epps was at the barricades on January the 6th at the Capitol grounds in Washington, D.C. Listen to this.
On January 6th, Mr. Epps is seen whispering to a person, and 5 seconds later, 5 seconds after he's whispering to a person, that same person begins to forcibly tear down the barricades. Did Mr. Epps urge them to tear down the barricades?
Sir, similar to the other answers, I cannot answer that.
Now, here's the thing. If you've got a guy who was actually doing the bidding of the FBI, and he was encouraging the crowd on the 5th of January, saying, we've got to get inside the Capitol building, and he doesn't get charged. And then he shows up at the barricades, and he has something to do with the barricades coming down, and he doesn't get charged with a crime. Ted Cruz wants to know whether or not elements of our government actually used people like Ray Epps, not just Ray Epps, but others, to actually go out and foment violence. Listen to his question and answer.
No one's explained why a person videoed urging people to go to the Capitol, a person whose conduct was so suspect the crowd believed he was a Fed, would magically disappear from the list of people the FBI was looking at. Ms. Sanborn, a lot of Americans are concerned that the federal government deliberately encouraged illegal and violent conduct on January 6th. My question to you, and this is not an ordinary law enforcement question, this is a question of a public accountability. Did federal agents or those in service of federal agent actively encourage violent and criminal conduct on January 6th?
Not to my knowledge, sir.
Not to my knowledge. Now, that sounds like one of the sleaziest answers I've heard in a long, long time. But remember, the FBI is a sleazy operation. They got rid of James Comey. They got rid of Andrew McCabe. They got rid of Peter Strzok. They got rid of Lisa Page. Why? Because the FBI was in the thick of it all the way back during the election. During the election of 2020, the FBI was in the middle of it. They were doing the political bidding of Hillary Clinton, the Democrat National Committee. They were doing all of that. Could you expect that an agency that would go out and lie to the FISA court, lie to the American public, lie about who was being prosecuted and who was getting attention or not, take part as a partisan activity, a partisan agency in dealing with the 2020 election? Would they also have tried to set up the Capitol riot so that immediately after the Capitol riot, what did Nancy Pelosi get? She got a predicate, an excuse to go out and carry out an unconstitutional and illegal impeachment of a president. And the Democrats would have you believe this was all about a bunch of crazy conservatives in America. I think it was all about an out-of-control federal agency. Just my take on it. And I'd like to know, if Ray Epps was one of those people doing it, why hasn't he been charged? And is it because he was actually working on behalf of the FBI? You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and your emails. You know, there are supply chain shortages that are still going on in this country, And I want to raise this question with Representative Ralph Norman, who's a member of Congress from South Carolina's 5th District. Welcome back to the program, Congressman.
Glad to be with you, Lars.
So tell me about this. Supply chain backlogs, and they're still going on, and they're creating real problems for the economy and for American consumers. I want to know how we go about solving this, and especially with Joe Biden kind of gumming up the works.
Well, you know, Lars, you look at what his actions show. I mean, where is he today? He and the vice president are in Georgia trying to pass a voting bill that will federalize all of our elections. The border's at a crisis. The inflation's at an all-time high. And as far as the backup in ships, we've got 105 ships, which is a record, on the port of Los Angeles in Long Beach last week. In yep. South Carolina, my home state, you've got 500 containers that have been sitting for more than 15 days. You've got a cost to get a ship on a ship carrying containers from China that's now $20,000 per ship in 2021 compared to $1,500. I mean, this president is tone deaf to time value of money. He's tone deaf to the businesses that are relying on getting their product. I don't know of anybody in this country that has not experienced some type of shortage, whether it's on the grocery market shelves, whether it's in construction, which is what I'm in. It's a crisis, and here he is, tone deaf to it. He's either spending our tax dollars or, he's doing what he's doing now, trying to weaponize the election system like he's done the judicial system.
You know, Congressman, there have to be people around the president. Every president can surround himself or herself, since he called her President Harris today at that speech you referenced down in Georgia. Even Joe Biden calls her President Harris. But he's got people around him who have to know what's going on and what the best solutions are. Are they just not telling the president, or is he just saying, I'm not going to do it because I'd run up against the unions?
No, he's that incompetent, Lars. I mean, when you say a week ago 2020 is going to be a good year, he's incoherent, and the powers that are the cabal that is running him that are telling him what to say. He's got a teleprompter, but he can't even read that. I mean, yeah. Follow his lips. He stumbles over simple words. The scary part about this is this is the leader of our free world, and he's got a vice president that. Is laughing her way through everything. And, everybody, and I think I'm not the exception, but when you get in district, they say, why? Why is all this happening? Where were the ships backlogged during President Trump? You didn't see it. Where was the inflation? You didn't see it. Where was the, the leaving American troops behind in countries? You didn't see it. So it's... I can't wait for the midterms to get here, but really, we've got a problem with this president, and the cabal that's running it is very, very concerning.
You know, Congressman, earlier today, Jen Psaki came out, and it's one thing when they will admit to the bad news, like, well, December was supposed to be 400,000 new jobs, it was less than half of that, it was 190,000. But when they start trying to telegraph ahead of time, like if you've got bad news coming, she came out today and said, oh, there's going to be some bad inflation news tomorrow. And you might wonder, why would she do that? I think it's because they think it softens the blow. When they know the bad news is coming, and they say, by the way, there's going to be some bad news tomorrow. But the things you mentioned, the hundreds and hundreds of ships and thousands of containers, all of that has yet to roll into the inflation numbers yet. But if you've got companies out there that are, say, getting parts for houses or cars or whatever it happens to be that are coming in containers that used to cost $1,500 to move them and now they're $20,000 a container, you know that the companies that are doing that can't afford not to roll those costs in. So that's future inflation that's going to come at us on top of already, as you pointed out, 40-year record inflation for this country. So that just speaks to, unless the situation changes dramatically in the next few months, the inflation we're seeing now, we're going to look back on as low by comparison to what we see this summer and this fall. Am I wrong?
No, you're exactly right. The worst is yet to come, unfortunately. And, Lars, get this. If we can put a man on the moon and get him back, and we can't unload a ship, We can't find the truckers, the drivers, because of this. A lot of it is with the vaccine mandate to yep. go to work. We're paying people not to work. I mean, it's all on the direct shoulders of this administration, because we didn't have it the last four years of Trump, and we sure are having it now. And the why question keeps coming up to me, and I can't answer it other than it's deliberate, it's incompetence, and it's tearing this country apart.
Well, I just hope that Republicans like you, I'm talking to Ralph Norman, who's a member of Congress in South Carolina, he represents the 5th District. You're over there on the East Coast. I'm on the left coast. But in California, for example, I've suggested, and I know, call me crazy, but if Biden were to pick up the phone and call Gavin Newsom, his Democrat buddy, who's done such a bang-up job of California, he almost got recalled, and say, listen, you got to temporarily suspend those CARB rules and let trucks come into California that are currently forbidden to come into California. You got to release the or reduce or suspend some of the vax mandates for drivers and things like that. You've got to actually operate the ports 24 hours a day, not just to benefit the unions, but to get that cargo loaded and out of the way, to get more of it unloaded and out of the way. I mean, I remember last fall when we were looking at 65 ships that were standing there in line, and now it's 105. And there's no guarantee that number won't go even higher. And frankly, Congressman, I hear from people who are unloading the cargo that some of it, which is not designed to sit in a metal box for several months offshore, it's designed to quickly get from Asian ports to the left coast of America. And when it sits out there for a while, an awful lot of it gets ruined. And again, ruined product is going to mean higher costs for everybody.
It does. And there is a limit to what people can afford. I mean, take the cost of housing. I mean, it's jumped. People say 18%. I would say more like 30%. And that's if you can get the product to build a home. I can't tell you the number of homes that are sitting that can't get finished. And you can go down this supply chain, the businesses that are suffering. And this is on top of the cost to carry, let the ships stay with the containers without being on the shelves. And it doesn't include the cost of gas and oil and everything else that it takes. It's just a train wreck. And this administration is not doing anything about it. His focus is anywhere but on solving the problems, which are man-made by this administration. And American people ought to be furious. I think they are, but there's a helplessness on what do we do? You know, how do we – I've written letters. I'm on the Oversight Committee. They ought to be testifying, not just on my committee, but in the news media, as to what's going on and how they're going to solve it. This isn't that complicated. And it's and the sad part, Lars, this administration is beginning the second year. All this has happened in the last 11 months since he took office on January 20th. It didn't have to happen. Nobody expected this, and it's continuing. And, you know, it's again, the midterms could not come quick enough. And get this, with what happened in Virginia, they're doubling down on all this. They blame everything either on racism or on other people or on Trump. I thought they blamed the snow on Trump that happened in Washington, D.C. But it's a train wreck.
Congressman, it is a pleasure as always. That's Congressman Ralph Norman from South Carolina. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. And of course, if you disagree with me or the guests, be a naysayer. Naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. By the way, this segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com. Go to NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Today's Twitter poll, should taxpayers subsidize electric cars for the poor? Now, that idea is coming out of Oregon, where the state is now doubling the rebate for one of its so-called clean vehicle programs. Why? Because Governor Kate Brown had set a deadline to achieve a goal of 250,000 registered electric vehicles in the state by 2025. By the way, that would be about 10% of the cars on the road right now. She wanted 250,000 by 3 years from now.
So far, they've managed to get to 42,000. They have fallen far short, adding an average of 10,000 cars a year in the years that the program has been in effect. Now she wants to somehow convince people to buy 60,000 electric cars per year for the next 3 years to make her goal, which I don't think is going to happen. So they're offering rebates that households, depending on your income, could get up to $5,000 in a state rebate on top of the federal rebates. Listen, if electric cars are the be-all and the end-all and the cat's meow and the best thing since sliced bread, you wouldn't think you'd have to pay people to go out and buy them. I wanted to mention this item from ShiftWA, which does a great job for the Evergreen State. Jay Inslee delivers his State of the State speech today. They say, we're not holding our breath that he'll address anything worthwhile, but they made up their own list of the issues he might not mention. Number one, the Democrats' pro-criminal legislation proposed for Olympia. Despite soaring crime rates, Democrats want to reduce the penalties for killers. A proposed bill would change the definition of aggravated murder, which carries a life sentence, to exclude drive-by shootings. And, you know, I'll add to what ShiftWA wrote. They're doing it because they say it's not fair to punish people for drive-by shootings because so many of those involve black suspects. Well, hold on a second. If they're doing the crime, they're murdering somebody in a drive-by, and you say we should exclude that from aggravated murder because it simply ends up implicating too many black criminals? I don't have a problem with implicating somebody who's a criminal. I don't care what their skin color is. I care that they killed somebody. Number two, restricting the executive's use of emergency powers. Inslee is on day 682 of abusing his emergency powers to control people's lives. Since the start of the pandemic, Inslee has cut state lawmakers, local government officials out of decision-making. His actions are a stark reminder of Democrats' disregard for the people's will. And finally, we'll remind you, just like my friend John Carlson has reminded people for years, Jay Inslee ran for governor when he first ran, promising he would have no new taxes. And since then, he gave that promise up basically on day one when he became governor. The state is now running an $8 billion surplus. Now, call me crazy, but when you've got an $8 billion surplus, do you need to raise taxes? But ShiftWA points out that Jay Inslee is going to continue defending the state income tax on capital gains, gas taxes, and of course that crazy long-term care tax that amounts to an income tax as well. So maybe he should mention some of those things too. To your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's go first to Jason. Jason, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I like the way Biden has to raise his voice to remind the American people that he's still in charge. You know, he has to scream and holler, you know, to emphasize himself. You know, no wonder people like Vladimir Putin is afraid to invade Ukraine right now.
Because Joe is raising his voice.
Yeah, he has to raise his voice. I mean, he's got me nervous. I mean, I'm kind of a nervous guy as it is. I mean, with the way things are going on, do you hear about the new variant that came out in Cyprus? I'm sorry.
You mean Omicron or something else? I'm sure there will always be a new variant.
Deltacron.
Deltacron.
Have you heard of the Deltacron variant?
No, I have not.
the Delta variant from last year?
That was last year's.
Yeah, on the island of Cyprus.
Oh, okay. Deltacron. Thank you very much. But, Jason, I appreciate the call. Let's go to Grant. Hey, Grant, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Well, I was going to kind of reflect on our little discussion you brought up earlier about using engaged in a recovery process for drug addiction via the decriminalization that we passed in Oregon.
Yeah, basically legalization of hard drugs with the promise that you would refer people to treatment, and they've referred almost nobody to treatment, and the people that were referred to treatment decided not to take it. So it sounds like we're just going to have more dead drug users.
Yes, and I mean, you may see that as a net positive, but I myself am a recovering heroin addict. Yeah, okay, good.
I don't see it as a positive. But the problem was, Grant, when you had some criminal penalties for possession of hard drugs, judges were able to get people into treatment. Now, the only thing you would pay is $100 if you're not willing to talk to somebody on the phone about drug treatment and say, thanks, I'm not interested. So you've
but got I've been listening to you for years, Lars, and I know that you are not a huge fan of getting the government to engage people into their own personal matters, correct?
I am a fan of having laws. Yes.
Yes, I agree with that as well. I mean, we are a nation of laws, but aside from that, a person's drug problem is not going to be addressed by a criminal citation.
It will because, Grant, we've got a history where people are accused of a crime and they show up in front of the judge and the judge says, if you'll go into treatment, I will suspend the felony charge against you. That was very effective. This is not very effective. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the region, the Pacific Northwest, the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And we like to supply honestly provocative talk. Can you imagine? There are times that I kind of miss being a reporter, you know, where I kept my opinion out and I just asked tough questions of people in public office. Wouldn't it be great to have somebody show up from either one of the states or any one of the three states, Idaho, Oregon, or Washington? Can you imagine showing up at a Jay Inslee press conference or a Kate Inslee press availability and saying, Governor, are the lockdowns and the mandates causing more deaths than COVID does? And see what Jay Inslee has to say, because I think you can make that case when you take a look at the effects. That is, we understand what the lockdowns are about. We understand what the mandates are about. But are they saving as many lives as they are costing? And the man who is willing to make that question is Lauren Culp, former police chief from Republic Washington, who is running to replace Dan Newhouse in Washington's 4th Congressional District. Chief, it's good to have you back.
Great to be on with you, Lars. Thank you.
So you made the case, and you've made the case, that that the lockdowns and the mandates are the cure is worse than the disease. Would you mind making the case for my audience?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, there. I just read a report, I believe it was yesterday, that there's been more people die from suicide, drugs, and alcohol than the amount of people that have died from COVID. And it's absolutely preventable. You know, when you lock people down, when you shut down businesses, when you tell people to stay home, when you fire people because they won't take the jab, that causes a lot of distress with people. They're trying to keep pumping up the numbers on this COVID sham, you know, and I'm not saying that people don't die from this, but more people, as I just stated, have died from other causes than COVID.
Well, for example, if you know, to back up what you're saying, Lauren, and it's good to have you on the program, by the way, 2019, there were 600 deaths in the state of Washington, for example, from overdoses, alcohol abuse, and suicide. 600 in 2019. How many did we have last year? 3,900. So you got almost a sevenfold increase, not quite, 6.5 times as many people dying from those three things as died in the year before. And you say, what changed? Well, the pandemic happened. But as you point out, COVID itself was not going to cause people to fall into despair. But the actions of government have caused people to fall into despair. I mean, if you get fired from your job, if your business is closed down and you go bankrupt, or you realize that even today there are businesses that were damaged so badly over the last year, they may or may not make it going forward. Now, can you imagine going home every night and thinking, I have a business that I've poured 5 or 10 or 20 years of my life into, or a job that I've done the same, and now I've been that's all been blown up. It's all gone. And for a lot of people, depending on their age, it may be too late to start over.
And yeah, and you add to the fact that a lot of those people, they go home to families. They have a wife, kids, a husband that depend on them, that aren't getting that income anymore. And there's a big question. Well, how are we going to continue? But to people like Jay Inslee and certain mayors of big cities, they don't care about that. They don't look at that. Because Jay Inslee is responsible for thousands of people losing their income, losing their careers in Washington State. It's absolutely pathetic.
Well, I got to tell you, Chief, one of the guilty parties is media. And I include myself in that. I'm asking the questions. But as I tell the audience all the time, I would love to have a nice, polite, but sharp-edged conversation with people like Jay Inslee and Kate Brown. But they won't do it. And most of the Democrats won't do it either. But if I won't do it, but there are reporters who have access, you could make Jay Inslee care. You could say to him, how is it that Snoqualmie Pass was closed down for 90 hours, which isn't just an inconvenience, but when it comes to bare shelves on the east side of the mountains, that's one of the reasons the shelves are bare. When you close down a major artery of commerce for 90 hours and you can't keep it open, and why? Because you fired a whole bunch of snowplow drivers and other people who work for WashDOT. Well, Chief, there are other states and other private institutions, both government and private institutions, that have said, you know, this vax mandate is crazy. We're not going to do it. And we've had major companies and major government. I mean, Amtrak said, we're not going to do it. USPS said, if you do it, the mail stops. We've had, I quoted a doctor earlier today from down in California saying the majority of the cases, and she's not a political firebrand, but she said the majority of the cases are what they call incidental. And I'm glad they finally invented a term for it, incidental cases of COVID. So you go into the hospital for an appendectomy that has nothing to do with COVID. And they say, by the way, we tested you as part of your admission to the hospital and you've got COVID. But you're asymptomatic. You're not showing the symptoms or anything like that. You're here for an appendectomy. We'll get that. And then they count it as a COVID case. She says in L.A. and San Francisco, the majority of the cases that are being mentioned every day in the news that we're using as an excuse to say the hospitals are overloaded are what they call the incidental cases, the almost invisible cases of COVID, because the person who has it doesn't have any symptoms and went to the hospital for something else.
Yeah, and they've been doing that since day one, Lars. If they didn't die from COVID, they died from something else. If they had COVID, it's a COVID death.
Yep.
You know, and we're having.
But the answer, Lauren, Chief, I want to ask you this: is it time for both reporters and politicians and everybody else to start saying to the governors and the people making decisions, is it time for you to reverse your stance on the vax mandates and get those people back on the job? I pointed out Rhode Island hospitals right now are hiring back unvaccinated staff that they let go because they said we can't run the hospitals otherwise.
Well, the mainstream media is complicit in this hoax because they're going right along with it. They're following the Democrat playbook, and they don't ask the tough questions, Lars. That's the reason why Jay Inslee and people like him won't come on your show. Because they'll get asked the tough questions, and they don't want to be confronted with the truth.
But can you imagine
right along with the narrative?
Can you imagine a better job for not getting exposed to COVID than driving a snowplow? I mean, Chief, you show up in the morning at the barn, you get in the snowplow, and you drive for 8 or 10 or 12 hours. Come home, climb out, go home. Somebody wipes down the inside of the truck. You're good to go. I mean, you're not exposed to anybody, are you?
No, exactly. No. And there was no reason to do that except Jay Inslee, King Emperor Inslee, said, you will do this or you'll be fired.
And the gutless legislature would not call him on it.
He doesn't understand the Constitution or anything else.
Well, because the gutless members of his own party, if a bunch of Democrats in Olympia got together with their Republican colleagues and say, we don't agree on anything else, but we do agree Jay needs to change this, and they took hold, but they don't have the guts to confront Jay Inslee himself and say, this is destroying the state. It is crippling the state, and you've got to reverse this. Lauren Culp is running to replace Dan Newhouse, the Rhino Republican from Washington's 4th Congressional District. Check out his website and find out more about his candidacy. Glad to be with you on a Tuesday. Always glad to take your phone calls and emails. Coming up, I'll get to your phone calls and your emails, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. If you haven't heard, within the last hour, President Joe Biden, who along with his Democrat colleagues over the years has staunchly opposed the idea of getting rid of the filibuster, now Joe Biden is perfectly happy to get rid of the filibuster to do what? To stage a federal takeover of local elections. Now, I know that some of you probably won't be as fired up by that as I am, but I'm concerned about what's going to happen this fall. I'm glad to see that there are states like Georgia and other states that have tough voting laws in place, and they made them even tougher after they saw what happened on November 3rd. They said, we want picture ID. We want to control the number of drop boxes. We want to limit activities like ballot harvesting. Well, Joe Biden and the Democrats don't want that. Senate Bill 1 and H.R. House Resolution 1 proposed to have a federal takeover of elections that would tell the states you're not allowed to demand picture ID. You're not allowed to limit ballot harvesting. In other words, while the Republicans, the conservatives, would like to make voting easy and cheating hard, the Democrats want voting to be easy and cheating to be easy. And now Joe Biden is so desperate to get a hold of this that he says, let's blow up the filibuster altogether. Let's get rid of it. And then we'll be able to vote this through on an ordinary majority. Except that Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia, said, I'm not going to go along with that. In any case, I thought I'd let you know about that, that Joe Manchin has already said, nope, I'm not going to back. I'm not going to back Joe Biden in this effort to get rid of the filibuster and simply ram these things through. And let me tell you why the Democrats are so desperate to ram them through. They're desperate because they understand this fall, if they can't cheat, they're going to lose the House. They're going to lose the Senate. They're going to lose a lot of governorships around America. They're going to lose state control of a lot of state legislatures. And they understand the only way they can maintain that control is if they can cheat in the elections. And I'd love to take a naysayer on that who knows the subject well, because I don't see an argument in favor of it. But let me go to your calls first. Let's go first to Patrick. Hey, Patrick, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
You had a call earlier about Measure 110, essentially. We were talking about, last November when we voted on it, I was just crazily shocked that it passed here in Oregon. I'm somebody that has the experience. I was arrested for drug possession a number of years ago. Then I did go through the court treatment system and that program, and it was a lifesaver for me. It got my life back on track. It got me off drugs.
Congratulations.
I think I would still be in the group doing that.
You know what? I'm glad you saved your life. Now, can we go back? The gentleman who called in about it a little bit earlier, he made the case, and we were right up against the top of the hour break, but he said having a criminal charge doesn't change the situation at all. So let me ask you about yours. If you don't mind sharing some of this, it may be deeply personal for you, but at the time when you were pushed to get into treatment, were you facing a criminal charge?
Absolutely. Yeah, I was faced with, I was caught with a small amount of drugs, and it was a felony charge, and I had basically three options. One was take it to trial, which was not going to work because it was an undercover cop. And option number two was to plead guilty, have a felony on my record, and spend some time in jail and that kind of thing. And the third thing was to take the court mandated or court option of treatment, which included going to court once a month and reporting to a judge. It got me counseling. It got me treatment. At that time, I didn't have health insurance, so I was able to go on, state health insurance and all that kind of stuff. So I had to have a job. I had to stay clean. I mean, it kept me in check, whereas the way things are now, as we know, you don't have to do anything more than listen to a phone conversation with somebody or pay a $100 fine.
No, and if you listen to the phone conversation and the $100 fine, do you think they actually successfully collect that $100 from drug addicts?
No.
Okay.
No.
So, Patrick, I got to tell you my experience on this. There was a judge by the name of Harl Haas. Harl Haas had his points, plus and minus, and I know about them. He's gone now. But he created one of the first drug courts in America. And I remember when he described it to me, I was a reporter then, and I said, how does this work? He says, we got all these people that get shuffled through the system. They get arrested for failure to appear, and then they're told to appear. They're written a notice, and then they don't appear. And it costs the system a lot of money. And I said, what do you do instead? He said, we tell the jail to hold on to these people. We'll get them in front of a judge within a day or two. And I said, what do you do? He says, I tell all of them, the state is, the prosecutor is ready to proceed right now. Do you want to, same options you were offered. Do you want to go to trial right now? And almost all of them are like you. They go, I'm going to be found guilty and I'm going to end up with a felony and I'm going to go to jail. Or do you want to go into voluntary treatment and follow the same process that you followed? Show up in front of a judge once a month and say, Your Honor, I'm still employed. I'm clean. He even said that he knew that people were going to occasionally fall off the wagon. Did you fall off the wagon at all during the year?
Yes.
And you got back on,
right?
Yeah,
yes.
Now, the question
like
is,
it was one strike and you're out. I mean, there was some flexibility and they were accommodating. Yeah.
Well, and the key thing is, would you have done any of that if you hadn't, if you'd been facing the choice of a $100 fine you weren't going to pay or a phone call?
No, because part of my history is I had been to treatment before, and it had nothing to do with a criminal matter or not. I was like, it to me, it took having that embarrassment, having that slice of humble pie handed to me to make me, you know, look at it and say, I don't want a felony on my record. You know, I don't want my life screwed up this way. So I'm willing to take the treatment option.
And it worked. How long you been clean?
5 years.
Are you ever tempted to go back?
No.
Good.
Absolutely not. No, it's
I'm
no.
I'm glad to hear it. What are the people around you? What do your friends and family think?
Well, I mean, they think it's great that it worked this time, because there are some family members that have seen me flounder for years. So, I mean, to me, it was just this was a time when it really meant something to me. It mattered, and it worked. So.
Well, congratulations, Patrick. Congrats on staying clean. Let's go to a naysayer. Robert, you're a naysayer. Let's get right to what you and I disagree about. What is it?
Hey, Lars. So you were only – I came in the criminal justice system back in the late 90s when Dan Noel was the sheriff, and he let everybody out of jail. Treatment was available for everyone. After that, treatment has not been available unless you have a criminal charge. It's ridiculous. How can you not step into a place and get help? There is nowhere. They say this. You got 30-day waiting, blah, blah, blah. You call. The beds are available. It's just not a reality unless you actually get
except
down.
Except that 110 funded extra treatment, and people aren't taking it, are they?
Well, okay, that's a new thing. I will say that.
It's a year old. It's been in place for a year, and nobody who gets tagged these days takes the treatment. And the reason is, you don't have to. All you have to do is talk to somebody on a phone for 10 minutes or pay a $100 fine, which I don't know how many drug addicts are likely to pay a $100 fine or be good for the $100 fine. What do you think? How many drug addicts are going to say, I'm going to pay the fine?
I live in downtown Portland, and I don't see a single cop out there. I see like one or two cops a day and night. I'm out there like maybe 12, 15 hours out of the day. And there's no one to write tickets, so I don't even know what you're speaking of. What do you mean?
Well, what I'm saying is they had 1,500 people tagged with tickets. 68 of them were actually referred to treatment. Nobody apparently took it. It isn't working, and we're going to end up with more deaths and more drug use, and that's a sad situation. You got the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. Always glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And I'm so pleased to have attorney Tom Rentz with me, Thomas Rentz, who's the lead attorney in several of the major cases brought in Ohio, New Mexico, Maine, and nationally against the CDC, Joe Biden, Anthony Fauci, and the whole bunch of them. Mr. Rentz, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Oh, glad to be back. How are you doing, Lars?
I'm not doing too badly, but I'm very frustrated by the actions of the government, which seem to me to be more damaging as the solution to COVID and now Omicron, the medicine is costing more than the disease was costing us. Am I wrong?
No, you certainly are not. I mean, we just saw that one of the ministers of the vaccine program over in the UK just quit and said, you know, we got to stop mass vaccination. It's a disaster. There's no question that this is a disaster. You know, one of the great spots to look is kids. You know, prior to the vaccination program in kids, no kids had died in the United States, the entire country, that didn't have some serious comorbidities and other issues related, and there'd only been, you know, less than 500 total. Now that we've got, you know, kids getting the jab, it's interesting to hear. I mean, there's certainly a spike in the number of kids getting COVID, and there seems to be a spike in, you know, children dying from random things, heart attacks and all sorts of things.
Well, and I'll tell you what, I'll read, there's a great little quote from it's called Stat, which is a medical news outlet. And they were looking at the FDA's model to see if the risk to boys ages 5 to 11, that's a key age range,
from myocarditis was actually greater than the risk, and what they concluded was the vaccine might trigger slightly more myocarditis hospitalizations than it would prevent in the same population. The benefits still might outweigh the risks, given that COVID cases that require hospitalization are generally more severe. But as you point out, you're talking about a patient population that Rochelle Walensky, the head of CDC, just admitted over the weekend. Sorry to tell you this, but almost 75% of the people who died had four comorbidities, other underlying problems, four or more of those. So we're talking about people who even she said were very, very unwell to begin with.
Well, and Lars, the thing that's amazing about that is not that she said it. It's that we've been talking about this for almost a year and a half.
Yep, we have.
This data's been out there. We knew it. We've been talking about it, and they tried to tell us we were conspiracy theorists. I mean, it was data. It was data then. It's data now. They lied then. They lie now. The question is, for the people that believe these people, why do you continue to believe liars? I mean, we've shown that they're liars. We know that they're liars. They continue lying. Why would you ever believe these buffoons?
Well, in fact, I don't know how often you're more on the civil side of things. But as a reporter, I covered all kinds of criminal court trials. And one of my favorite jury instructions judges would give was they would tell the jury, the judge, whoever the judge happened to be, would say, and they said it the same way every time. They'd say to the jury, if you find that a particular witness has lied in some or all of his testimony, you are free to disbelieve or believe any of his testimony. In other words, if they've lied to you once, they may have lied more times than that. And that's what judges tell juries when they're making the most critical decisions that we know of, locking people up for life or putting them to death. And that's what judges tell juries. Why wouldn't we react the same way? Fauci's a liar. I'm not going to believe anything he says. Biden's a liar. I'm not going to believe anything he says.
Well, I mean, that's the question. These people, they've been lied to for 2 years now, and some of them are having a hard time believing because they're having a hard time admitting to themselves and everybody else that they've been lied to for 2 years. But the reality is that they have. And, what do you got to do? You got to poison your kids to believe it? You got to watch your kids die first? I mean, what's got to happen before you're willing to say, yeah, we got defrauded?
Well, and that we don't end up with the freedom to make the decision. Tom, you're an attorney, but even as an average person out there, we all make judgment calls about weighing risks. If the kids all want to go skiing this weekend and you say, yeah, we're going skiing Saturday morning, and you wake up Saturday morning and there's a blizzard blowing, you say, we could drive through the blizzard. We're certainly capable of it. But why would we put ourselves at somewhat greater risk of injury or death to go skiing? Okay, skiing is not as important as staying alive. So you make a judgment call. And parents do this all the time. Adults do this all the time. But our politicians seem incapable of allowing us to make our own decisions.
Well, what they're incapable of is allowing us to do things that don't result in them getting additional money from the special interests. They're so incapable of doing that they just demonstrated how incapable they are in the Supreme Court of the United States, which I got to tell you, I'm pretty fired up about that.
You mean Sotomayor? Tell us what we should make of the fact that a Supreme Court justice either lied and knowingly said something that was that was hugely untrue, or she just doesn't know what she's talking about.
Well, I'll tell you, Lars, I'll tell you what I'm going to do is I'm going to go a direction that pretty much nobody thinks of. So as an attorney, when I watch that, here's what I can tell you. There is no one on this planet that would be surprised that Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor would think what they thought. If you were surprised about that, then, I don't know. You've apparently been under a rock or not watching the court. So zero surprise on that. Here's what got me. It wasn't anything that any of those three said. I would have expected them to say that sort of nonsense anyways.
Okay.
What got me was the attorneys who were supposed to be representing our side. Those guys were 1,000 times worse than Sotomayor's biggest mistake ever. Because, see, there's a four-part test. That case was, we were asking for them to reimpose a stay. which means, you know, stay the order, say, you know, no OSHA order.
Right.
To do that, there's a four-part test. The fourth part of that test is the public interest. Is it in the public interest to stay this order? So everyone that's a lawyer, anyone that's going to argue that knows that you have to argue each of those four questions. And the fourth one's the public interest. And so you know, as an attorney, that when you go in there, the justices, especially Kagan, Sotomayor, and Breyer, are going to talk about how great the vaccine is and how terrible the disease is, and you know that you're going to have to defend that. These buffoon lawyers, who I'm trying to decide whether they threw the case or not, these guys went in there. The one guy is bragging about being triple vaxxed. They're both talking about how safe and effective it is. They're talking about how deadly the disease is. I thought they were making the other side's argument. I wasn't sure if they were working for Biden. Yeah. I don't know what was going on there. But, I mean, this is, Lars, this is the equivalent to you hiring me to represent you in a car wreck. And my defense is, yeah, but you were drunk.
Yeah.
Your Honor, you can't convict him. He was drunk. It wasn't his fault he got in the wreck. I mean, it's unbelievable. They went in there and they said, their argument was this, okay? And they were correct as a rule of law. They were correct, okay? But their argument was this. Their argument was, you know, it's illegal under the statute for, you know, OSHA to do this. It's a power they don't have. So they're correct on that.
Yeah.
They should win on the merits. They should, you know, the balance of harms, so on and so forth. All this stuff to me goes or should go towards our side, and we should win this case.
Yeah.
But what they said was, Your Honor, this is the worst, most dangerous plague on the planet. Never faced anything like it. It's killing everybody in the universe. We're all going to die. The only hope is the vaccine. We love the vaccine. We think it's great, and it's the best way to do it.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Our Twitter poll today brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Should taxpayers subsidize electric cars for the poor? There's so many things crazy about that idea, it's almost hard to count. Number one, $5,000 in subsidy on top of federal subsidies that are already available. They would apply this to either brand new or used, fully electric or hybrid vehicles. In other words, Kate Brown wants you to buy whatever you can buy. I've got to make some numbers. And why? Because 4 years ago, Kate Brown said, we have a goal to get 250,000 electric cars on the road by 2025. Well, that was a while ago. Now it's only 3 years till her goal. And how far have they gone on that goal of getting 250,000 electric vehicles in the state by 2025? They have 42,000. So they are a long ways short. And if they're going to get it by 2025, they have to get it this year, next year, and the year after that. And then the goal is up. Are they going to sell 60,000 electric cars a year, every single year for the next 3 years? I seriously doubt it. But should the taxpayers be subsidizing it? No. And the second issue, and this one a little harder to define, I don't own an electric car. I wouldn't mind owning an electric car if they made sense. They do not make sense for most people. Now, imagine yourself, if you are somebody of limited means, let's say somebody who's poor, who this program is going to apply to. Where do an awful lot of poor people live? They live in apartment buildings because it's less expensive than renting a house, and it's less expensive than buying a house, and it may be outside their means. So you say to them, I'm going to dangle $5,000 out here if you'll buy an electric car. And you say, great, I'm going to buy an electric car. I live on the third floor of an apartment building because I can't afford nicer. My apartment building does not have a car charger. So how am I supposed to charge this stupid car that gets me to work so I can earn my living and maybe improve my circumstances? And the answer is, it's not going to do a very good job. You're going to have it parked some distance away from where your actual house is, which is where the electricity is. Oh, but we're going to provide electric car chargers. You know, Joe Biden promises to install 500,000 of them around America, and there might be one in your neighborhood. Or maybe you can take a chance and you'll have to juice up your car every day before you return home from work or after you've left in the morning on your way to work. And does that work for most people?
who are of limited means. It doesn't make any sense. I'd love to talk to the people behind this program. We're going to call them. We'll offer them a chance to come on. I seriously doubt we're going to get them, but we'll make the invitation anyway. Anyway, it's the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to have you with me. Let's go to Randy. Hey, Randy, thanks for listening. And what's on your mind today?
Lars, stop making too much sense. Anyway, you're doing a great job, a great show so far. I was calling about another communist agitator that happens to be a lady politician. I was watching the news, and Joanne Hardesty let me know that the transportation system in Southeast Portland is racist, and it's not adequate, and it doesn't serve the people well, and that she's giving out free bicycles. I don't know if she's been around Southeast Portland, but there's piles of bicycles. Everyone could have there's bikes everywhere. They just have piles of them. The homeless have piles of them. But it's just another stupid idea. I hate to say that. That's a harsh word. Just like, you know, when they put the yard signs in that said do not murder, and they put up the barrels that say locals only. And if there's a problem, why doesn't Joanne Hardesty call up the head of TriMet and have a meeting.
TriMet's another failed government agency. I mean, just this week, TriMet announced we're going to cut service. Now, Randy, you tell me if you can apply any kind of common sense to this. You have a massive federal agency that runs on a multiple $100 million annual budget. They have had declining use of their service over the last 30 years. That is, the number of people who travel on mass transit per capita, meaning even as the population increases, you're measuring apples to apples. The answer is it's going down, not going up. And why? Because most people prefer to have a private automobile. And you say, well, that's just a preference of the rich. No, it's not. It's a preference of everybody, especially those who cannot modify their schedule. Doctor, lawyer, accountant may be able to say, I'm going to come in every day at 10 a.m. and then I'll leave at 8 o'clock at night or whatever. They can time shift. Do you think the average wages worker can tell the boss, I'm not going to show up till 10 o'clock, but I'll be glad to stay till 6 o'clock at night? That doesn't work. So if you say, we're going to have all this transportation available, it ignores the fact, and this is the thing I wish every reporter would put in a story about bicycles, 95% is the number of people who get where they're going here in the Pacific Northwest in a private automobile. The other 5% walk to work, take a bike, take transit, take an Uber, whatever, right? That's 5%. The system couldn't even handle it if it went to 8% or 9%. And yet they say we're going to get in the kind of region we're in with the kind of weather we have, you're going to get a massive number of people to start using bicycles. Oh, how do you pick up your kids from daycare? After you get off work and bicycle home, and it takes you two or three or four times as long to get to your kids? How do you go grocery shopping? How do you do any of those common things that every single family has to do if you're doing it on a bicycle? And then somehow you're going to get people to say, yeah, I'll give up my my car, you know, because I only have to go 8 miles to my job. So, I mean, for people who decide to do it for health reasons and they say, I'm going to bicycle 8 miles to work and 8 miles home every day, mostly in the dark in the wintertime, mostly in the rain in the Pacific Northwest. If that makes sense to anybody, I'd be glad to take your email or your phone call. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network.